From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Historian Martin Duberman went to a number of psychiatrists in the 1950s and 60s, seeking a cure for what they then defined as a pathology, homosexuality. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Duberman about being gay before the gay liberation movement. Last week, actor and writer Wallace Shawn won the Obie Award for Best New Play. The play reveals his own guilty conscience about his privileged life. Coming up, Shawn performs an excerpt, and we find out what he feels so guilty about. And book critic John Leonard reviews Immortality, the new novel by Czechoslovakian writer Milan Kundera. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Soviet Parliament today finally approved, in principle, the long-awaited law giving Soviet citizens the right to travel abroad. But Parliament delayed implementation of the bill until 1993. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Soviet advocates of the bill called it an historic act. The White House said it was a good first step. The administration said it's still unclear if the law meets its conditions for granting the Soviet Union most favored nation status and other trade benefits, which have long been linked to freer emigration. The law must still go through a cumbersome ratification process where opponents can still change or block it. But the country's parliament appeared to overcome most objections today by agreeing to delay implementation to 1993. The debate over the law had bogged down over the projected costs of processing the expected flood of travelers. Opponents argued the country could ill afford this bill now. But others say there's unlikely to be a sudden crush of people trying to leave the country. The right to leave the Soviet Union doesn't mean Soviets have the right to enter other countries. And several Western governments are now the ones throwing up the barriers, fearing that with the economic crisis at home, Soviets will look for jobs abroad. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Students who've received government loans to attend college or trade school owe the government $2.7 billion, yet the U.S. Department of Education has done little to stop or punish them or the unscrupulous schools that have skimmed millions of dollars from the federal government's student loan program. That was the conclusion of a report released today by a Senate investigating committee. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
After a year-long study, the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations reported today that the loan program's huge growth, coupled with a complete breakdown in effective regulation and oversight, had opened the door for fraud, abuse, and mismanagement. Not one of the program's major components are working, said Senator Sam Nunn, Democrat of Georgia, who chaired today's panel on the subject. Nunn added that the $12.5 billion program has lost credibility and its future may be hanging in the balance. Today's report offered a scathing evaluation of the Bush administration's handling of the federal student loan crisis. In its 27 recommendations, the report proposes that the Secretary of Education, Lamar Alexander, begin a major and drastic effort to curb waste and abuse by reorganizing the department's oversight of the program, that the department require banks and other lenders to share a greater risk in the loans they make to students, and that the government make sure schools that are eligible under the student loan program be scrutinized. There are over $52 billion in student loans outstanding. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 2,892. Advances edged declines in light trading of 110 million shares. This is NPR News. The Bush administration said today that it will resist any lifting of economic sanctions against Iraq as long as Saddam Hussein remains in power. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. policy includes opposition to allowing Iraq to sell oil. Iraq has asked the United Nations for authority to sell $1 billion worth of oil, which it says it needs to buy food and medicine. Fitzwater said the U.S. policy was outlined in a speech by Deputy National Security Advisor Robert Gates. Gates, who's been nominated to head the CIA, said that Iraqis will pay the price as long as Saddam remains in power. A Chicago hospital is saying that needles picked up by two children in an examining room may have been previously used on a patient with AIDS. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
An attorney for the families of the two children went to court today to obtain the needles from Illinois Masonic Hospital for further testing. The girls, cousins aged 15 months and 3 years, were with one of their mothers in an examining room when they took a needle from a disposal bin. Both children have been given the AIDS treatment drug AZT as a precaution. This is the second recent incident in which visitors or patients at the hospital have charged that possible employee error may have exposed them to the virus that causes AIDS. Another woman is suing Illinois Masonic, charging that she was examined last month with a previously used cotton swab. The hospital has closed its outpatient clinic while an independent panel investigates both incidents. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
A leading expert on AIDS said today that the disease is spreading to new parts of the world at the same time that society's willingness to fight it appears to be waning. Dr. Jonathan Mann is the director of the International AIDS Center. He told an annual conference in San Francisco that the HIV virus that causes AIDS is now spreading among women, children, and racial minorities. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Martin Duberman came of age before the gay liberation movement. Psychiatrists still considered homosexuality a pathology, and he believed them. He went into therapy seeking a cure that could end the desires he was unable to repress. Duberman's new memoir, Cures, is his story about being gay in the 1950s and 60s, trying unsuccessfully to change who he was. Duberman is now a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He has made important contributions to gay history and has also written a recent biography of Paul Robeson. He was on the founding boards of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the Gay Academic Union. He told me that he thinks his story is fairly typical of the gay men of his generation.
One of the hopes I have for the book, even if it wasn't the intention for writing it, is that it will tell the story of a particular generation of gay men. And from the letters I've been getting so far about the book, I'm striking a chord, at least with those who are writing me letters. Of course, at the same time, it's a very privileged story, and in that sense, it's not representative.
In the sense that you were in the closet teaching at Princeton.
Exactly,
yeah.
And I was able to afford to go to therapy. Alas, would that I hadn't been able to afford it, but in that sense, too, it's privileged.
Now, your parents first sent you to a therapist when you were 15. They didn't know you were gay. You probably didn't really know either.
I think I did, actually.
Think you did?
Yeah, I think I've always known.
But the therapist didn't know. Why did they want you to go to a therapist? What did they perceive as your problem at the time?
Well, they knew that outside the house, I was very gregarious. I tended to be a leader. And I was certainly articulate. And in the house, I was monosyllabic. All they could get out of me was, you know, a grunt, yes or no, at dinner. They had no idea what was wrong, and they thought a therapist might.
Now, you went to see this therapist. It was on your mind, right, that you knew you were different from heterosexuals in some in some fundamental way, but you weren't going to tell your psychiatrist about it.
No, not that first one. I wasn't going to tell anybody. I was barely telling myself. I was sort of semi-conscious of my sexuality. And that's one reason I think I was silent around the house. I didn't want anybody to begin to get near me so that they might learn my terrible secret. And that first therapist, I can remember I disliked him on sight and didn't trust him at all. And his cure, the first of many, was that I should go home, throw my arms around my mother, and tell her I loved her. I mean, literally, that was his cure. And I did it. I tended to do everything I was told for a while, till my rebelliousness belatedly surfaced. But I did it. You know, and the poor woman was enormously thrilled and excited, you know, and cried and said I knew it would all turn out all right. And I thought to myself, oh, this is terrible. This is grotesque. Anyway, that was a fairly short-term set of visits because she reported to the therapist that, wonderful, you've cured him. And so that he loves me. So that was the end of that therapy.
So it showed you how superficial some of these signs of success could be.
Oh, yeah. Well, I never talked to that therapist about my vague feelings that I was homosexual.
Now, you later went into therapy yourself. You decided to go to therapy. What got you into therapy that second time?
Well, the second time was in the mid-50s when I was in graduate school at Harvard, and I was in a love affair which had helped a lot in making me more comfortable with being who I was. I mean, there's nothing like the magic of love to think, I really am okay, even though I'm not following society's dictates. But our relationship, like all relationships, started to have some problems after a couple of years. And instead of assuming that these could be worked out, we bought the culture's message, which was anybody who is homosexual is incapable of intimacy, incapable of sustained long-term commitment. And having internalized all of that, we felt, well, these aren't run-of-the-mill problems with a relationship. These instead are symptoms of an underlying condition which makes all significant relating impossible. So I dutifully, you know, trooped into a therapist's office again.
And how long did it take for you to tell him that you were gay?
I think I told him right away because I came the second time. By then I was in my mid-20s, I guess. The second time I came with a clear purpose to change my sexual orientation because the problems in the love affair had convinced me that if I stayed homosexual, I'm using homosexual because that's the word we used then, that there was no chance for happiness. So I arrived with a clear agenda, you know, make me straight.
Now, this was still in the days when homosexuality was seen as a pathology within the psychiatric profession.
Entirely. There was no dissent in those years. That's why almost everyone of my generation did internalize the message, because there were no counter-messages. There were a few people who were beginning to do work, like preeminently Evelyn Hooker in the late 50s. She had, what happened in that case, and she lived in California and she knew a lot of gay men, and none of them were in therapy. They were quite content with their lives, and they finally said to her, look, you've got to do a study on us. You know, the only studies to date are studies of people who are miserable and therefore seek therapeutic help. And she did. And just as those gay men had predicted, the results turned out to be these are people who are very content with their lives and very well adjusted. And she did all kinds of blind studies and comparisons. And, you know, they cannot be detected if you compare them with heterosexual men. The same kinds of lives in terms of contentment. Or lack of it, but in any case, they can't be separated out. That was a beginning, but Evelyn Hooker's early studies appeared in very technical journals, and it was many years before those studies really hit the mainstream.
When you told your psychiatrist that you were homosexual and it was making you unhappy, did he think he had a cure for you?
Absolutely.
And what was it?
Part of the message of those years was not only, I mean, the first part was homosexuality is pathology. The second part was this particular pathology can be cured. And he had no doubt, nor did my later therapist in the 60s have any doubt, but that if I had the requisite will, and that was important, if I really wanted to change, they could all but guarantee the results.
I love that because it puts the ball back in your court.
Exactly.
You know? And if you can't become a heterosexual, it ain't my fault. It's your fault.
That's it. Well, that's the tyranny of therapy. I mean, the issue that arises is never the therapist's issue or the therapist's problem. It's always something the patient is doing wrong. That's why it can so easily be a form of fascism.
So what were some of the cures that your psychiatrist suggested could convert you from homosexuality to a more normal heterosexuality?
Well, the first step was I had to, as they put it, stop my acting out.
Meaning
I had to stop all homosexual contact. That first therapist in the mid-50s, instead of helping me to clarify the issues between me and the man I was in love with, who I call Larry in the book, instead of doing that, which is what a good therapist would do today, he told me immediately I had to break off the relationship with Larry. That it was a form of acting out, that this was how my underlying anxiety expressed itself. So the first step is you close the escape hatch, you stop acting out, then the anxiety surfaces, and you're able to analyze it. And as a result of the analysis, you then move toward that glorious end product we call heterosexuality.
Did you break off the relationship?
I did. I then broke off the therapy. I mean, I kept going back and forth. I was utterly ambivalent and torn. It was a ghastly couple of years.
Now, what's another cure that you were given?
Well, in the 60s, when I started therapy with Carl, and the center of the book is about that therapy, I was encouraged to date. And in that therapy, I was in group therapy. So I was encouraged to get close, at least during group sessions, with the women in that group. And every time, you know, I would report back that I had at least enjoyed an evening with a female friend or a date. I mean, the therapist would, you know, cry the equivalent of Hosanna. It's, you see, it's taking. You know, the magic is taking. Any day now or any year, you're going to make the final transition.
Would he push you to try to have sexual encounters with women to prove to yourself that you could do it?
Not overtly. And what continued to discourage all my therapists was that I never developed any erotic feelings for women. I never fantasized about them. I never had dreams about them. I have always been one of those people who's, for whatever reasons, is exclusively gay. You know, I'm a Kinsey 6, that scale, you know. 0 to 6, 0 is exclusively straight, and 6 is exclusively gay. And I've always been a 6. I pushed myself a little earlier in my life. You know, I tried to have sex, everything from the proverbial visit to the whorehouse to trying to have sex with my prom dates, but it never worked for me.
Did your psychiatrist ever get into trying to analyze the reasons for your homosexuality, your relationship with your parents, or, you know, things from your past that must be responsible for this aberrant behavior?
Oh, yeah. Again, there was a decided party line in those years. I mean, the psychiatric profession was uniform in its ideology, and that ideology said that a certain kind of family configuration will produce, in my case, a gay son. They had a reverse theory for a lesbian daughter. And what the family configuration was, you know, a strong, overpowering, suffocating mother in combination with an absent or a distant or a hostile father. Irving Bieber, the psychoanalyst, wrote a book in 1962 called Homosexuality, which became the Bible of the profession. It seemed to confirm that configuration which I just described. In fact, and it became, I mean, he was showered with awards and he was an eminent figure. In fact, it's a very shoddy study, though that only became clear, you know, 10 years later.
In all the cures that you were exposed to, were you ever trying behavioral conditioning?
Fortunately, no, though that was also rampant in those years and right through the 60s. What they would do in terms of a gay man again, they would put the man on an electric grid. They would stand him on it, and then they would flash pictures of naked men or men with erections, and then they would give the patient a shock. And, of course, that induces a certain amount of aversion to same-gender sexuality. You can produce certain kinds of behavioral changes in people. Masters and Johnson have another form of this. But what you don't change is they're in a fantasy life. You don't change, really, the direction of their erotic lust. So what you're producing, in essence, is a kind of schizophrenia. You're producing a great disparity between the inner life and the outer behavior.
Of all the things that your psychiatrist suggested that you do, what do you think was the most damaging to you to participate in?
Well, I'm not sure participate, but I think what was most damaging to me was the negative self-image that it engendered in me. I mean, the way I saved my life finally was, and I was very lucky I was able to, I developed as a mechanism for coping with anxiety and self-hate, I developed into a kind of workaholic. I kept busy, 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 and to this day, I still keep busy.
I think people always wonder when they hear stories about psychiatrists who maybe have good intentions, but have techniques that are going to end up being more damaging than anything else. People wonder, why did you submit to him? Why did you follow through on something that so went against your nature and what you must have known in your gut? Let me ask you about why you followed through on what the psychiatrist suggested, even though it really went against the grain for you. And even though you really didn't trust him very much in a lot of ways.
I think though, to grow up in this country in those years, and to some extent still, you become homophobic yourself. You kind of take it in with your pablum in the morning. I mean, it's... So therefore, when you get that kind of, you know, official expert opinion saying you are a sickie, what it does is it confirms your own negative feelings about yourself, which pre-exist if you're a gay person or a lesbian. And I had a hell of a time working my way out of that, because all those negative messages eventually form a kind of imprinting. It's hard to believe something opposite, something more positive.
When did you decide to leave conventional therapy?
It wasn't until 1970. And I left finally because there had been a lot percolating, thanks to the wonderful 60s, which can't return too soon, but there aren't any signs that they're about to. I got various, and lots of people got various messages in the 60s that were important to our own liberation, even though they weren't addressed directly at us. And I'm thinking of women here as well as gays. With the message I got from the black movement, subliminal, was, you know, it's not only okay to be different, it's wonderful to be different. You know, black is beautiful. Black is not second rate or second class. And you don't have to be a carbon copy middle class white in order to think well of yourself. And then the message I got, you know, during the anti-war movement from the student radicals was, don't trust the experts. The experts got us into Vietnam. And that message applied across the board. I mean, challenge all institutional authority, all received wisdom. So you put those two together, it's okay to be different, and the experts usually don't know what the hell they're talking about. And finally, you begin to realize that maybe you're okay. And maybe you ought to start asserting your differentness instead of apologizing for it.
My guest is historian and gay activist Martin Duberman, and he's also a university professor as well. He's written many books, including a biography of Paul Robeson. His new book is autobiographical. It's called Cures, A Gay Man's Odyssey. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is historian and gay activist Martin Duberman, and his new book is autobiographical, and it's called Cures, A Gay Man's Odyssey. When you were first exposed to the gay liberation movement in the 60s, were you skeptical of it?
I was, yeah. It was kind of double vision. I mean, I was attracted and I was appalled all at once. I began to reach out once therapy ended. I reached out to a gay liberation front consciousness-raising group. I stayed for one whole session. I decided, you know, the people weren't serious enough or smart enough, or, you know, you can always sandbag yourself in these ways. And then next I went to Gay Academic, not academic, Gay Activists Alliance, and I took part in some sessions for beginners. I was already 42 years old, and most of the people in the room were in their early 20s. But nonetheless, in a real sense, I was a novice, and I needed to begin at the beginning. And then after a while, the change was quick. I'd always had a rebellious side, fortunately, and a lot of doubts had accumulated in me. And as I say in the book, once I punched through the wall really did seem paper thin. And so quickly thereafter, I became, you know, I sat on the first organizing board of Lambda Legal Defense. I was on the originating board of the National Gay Task Force, all this by 72 or 73. And also I was one of the founders of the Gay Academic Union. So once the momentum began, it did quickly accelerate.
Well, as you pointed out, you were in your early 40s when you became part of the gay liberation movement, and a lot of the people were in their 20s. or probably early 30s. And this was a period in which there was a lot of distrust of people who were older
yes.
on the part of people who were younger. So I wonder if you felt marginalized in a way, even within the gay movement, because you were older than some of the other people who were in it.
I did. I guess by the time I hit the Gay Academic Union, though, there were people roughly my own age. I was still, say, 5 years older. But that's where I first felt I found a truly congenial group, and it was.
That also combined, like, your professional and private life
yeah.
in a way that could really bring all of your interests together, really unite who you were.
Yeah, exactly. I felt that I was much better integrated as a result of being around these other gay academics.
Were there any risks to you professionally in coming out then?
I was pretty well protected by the time I came out. I had tenure. I had a long list of publications. I've never suffered that kind of overt discrimination as a result of coming out, though lots of people do. I want to emphasize that because mine was a very privileged position. Nonetheless, I have suffered some subtle kinds of discrimination. For example, I used to be invited to write for broad range of publications on a broad range of social issues. Once I came out, I was pigeonholed as a gay polemicist, and it was widely assumed that I no longer had anything of relevance to say on any issue other than homosexuality. So I stopped getting those invitations.
I should bring up here that your next to the last book, the book right before Cures, was about Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any trouble getting that published because you'd already become pegged as a gay activist and writer?
No. In that case, The Sun had come to me and invited me to do the book, and so I had a contract to do it before I even began it. And that book has gone some way toward making me a little more viable again as a general commentator on social issues.
I wonder if you think that there's a lot that people who are heterosexual have to learn from hearing the stories of gays and lesbians and how they've lived their lives and how they've come out and how they relate to gender. In other words, if you think that there's things that heterosexuals can really learn about sex and gender by hearing the stories of people who are different from them.
Yeah, I think the lessons that are not only critical, but I think this conformist culture desperately needs to hear them, the messages. For example, in the last 5 years, 10 years, we've seen the emergence of gay-lesbian studies on the campuses. It's a burgeoning movement that's developing very rapidly. And the data that has already emerged from gay-lesbian studies, I feel, has an enormous amount to say to everybody, regardless of their orientation. To give just a few examples, the emerging information about gays and lesbians tells all of us a lot about the artificiality of standard gender roles. It also tells us a lot about the connection between gender and sexuality. Lesbian women, for example, are far less willing to take on, the traditional pretense that women are not sexual. They are decidedly pushing the boundaries of female sexuality, and that's useful information for all women. And also, the new information has a lot to say about how anybody forms an identity, how people form identities in common, what we call subcultures or communities, how those subcultures influence the mainstream. I think critical and unique data is emerging from gay-lesbian studies and gay-lesbian lives. I'm not terribly confident that the mainstream, will listen to the information, but I certainly think they could profit from it.
Martin Duberman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Martin Duberman's new memoir is Cures, A Gay Man's Odyssey. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You probably know Wallace Shawn from the film My Dinner with Andre. He wrote and starred in it. And from his roles in such films as The Princess Bride and Manhattan. Coming up, Shawn performs an excerpt of his one-man play. It just won an Obie Award for Best New Play. And we discuss its subject, feeling guilty about being privileged. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Immortality, the new novel by Czechoslovakian writer Milan Kundera. He also wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being and The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Bush administration officials and congressional critics say that they welcome a plan by the American Red Cross to revamp its blood bank system. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
The American Red Cross collects about half of the blood used for transfusions in the United States through a system of 53 loosely knit blood banks. Today, Red Cross President Elizabeth Dole announced that the organization will be tied together into one tightly controlled system in order to fix persistent administrative problems identified by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The major public concern is AIDS, though health officials say they don't know of a single case of that disease caused by the Red Cross's bureaucratic troubles. In fact, only 15 cases of AIDS have been attributed to tainted transfusions since blood banks started testing for AIDS in 1985. The Red Cross's reorganization plans are designed to maintain that high standard while reassuring the public that the nation's blood supply is safe. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
President Bush says that he is opposed to lifting economic sanctions against Iraq as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. Earlier in the day, Secretary of State Baker said Washington was not interested in seeking an easing of sanctions while Saddam Hussein was in power. As for trials now underway in Kuwait, Mr. Bush called on Kuwaiti officials to extend a fair trial to everyone accused of cooperating with Iraqi forces who occupied the nation for 6 months. In an opinion written by the court's only female justice, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that under some circumstances, states may bar an accused rapist from introducing evidence of past sexual relations with an alleged rape victim. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Nolan Lucas was accused by his ex-girlfriend of rape. She said he forced her at knife point to have sex. He said she consented to have sex and did not leave his apartment until the next day. But when Lucas tried to introduce evidence about the couple's past sexual relations, the judge refused to allow it, noting that Lucas had failed to comply with Michigan's Rape Shield law. That law generally bars evidence of a victim's past sexual conduct, but it permits it if the alleged rapist notifies the court within 10 days of his arraignment that he wishes to introduce evidence of past consensual sexual contact with the victim. The judge is then to hold a hearing to determine if the evidence is relevant. Since Lucas never notified the judge as required by law, the judge did not permit the evidence, and Lucas was convicted. He claimed he was deprived of his constitutional right to confront his accuser. Today, the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, upheld Michigan's rule in general, but sent the case back to the state court to see if Lucas, in particular, was denied a fair trial. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 5 points to close at 2,892. This is NPR News. German Chancellor Kohl, speaking today in Washington, called for creation of a United States of Europe. Kohl says that his first job is to ensure German unity and then to take part in building a lasting peaceful order for Europe, which brings together all nations. Kohl pointed out that his country is spending more than $33.5 billion to aid the Soviet Union, along with other expenditures to help Eastern Europe in a move away from communism. Kohl called on Americans to invest in Eastern Europe. Polish President Lech Wałęsa, now on a state visit to Israel, has asked the Jewish people for forgiveness for the Holocaust. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
President Wałęsa made the request during an emotional speech to the Israeli Knesset, or parliament. He said, "Here in your homeland, I ask forgiveness for those in my country who cooperated with the Nazis." But Wałęsa also said that many Poles tried hard to save Jews. More than 2 million Jews were killed in Poland during the Holocaust, including most of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's family. Shamir today met Walesa. He asked him to close the PLO embassy in Warsaw. Shamir also said Israel will help Poland transform itself into a market economy. Walesa will be in Israel for 4 days on the first visit by a Polish head of state. He said he hopes for closer ties between the Jewish and Polish peoples. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
At trade talks in Japan, Tokyo and Washington blamed each other for failing to do more to cut their trade imbalances. Japanese officials said that U.S. efforts to cut down on Washington's trade deficit has not been adequate, while U.S. officials said that they were disappointed with the lack of Japanese action in some key areas. Last year's U.S. trade deficit with Japan came to $38 billion. According to the Japanese Finance Ministry, that's down from $47 billion the year before. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last week, writer and actor Wallace Shawn won the Obie Award for Best New Play for his one-character play, The Fever. The Obies are off-Broadway awards sponsored by The Village Voice. The Fever is about an American traveler in a third-world country under siege. There's fighting around his hotel. He's lying sick on the bathroom floor, overcome by guilt over his privileged position in the world. I should mention here that Shawn is the son of William Shawn, the revered former editor of The New Yorker. Wally is best known for writing and starring in the film My Dinner with Andre. He was featured in Manhattan, The Princess Bride, and lots of other films. Shawn has written several plays, but he says The Fever was his attempt to get out of theater. His first performances were in people's living rooms, but he's since taken The Fever to the Public Theater, Lincoln Center, and La Mama in New York. Tomorrow he begins a run at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. When The Fever was published in book form, we invited Wallace Shawn to talk with us and to perform an excerpt of The Fever.
So I'm sitting, shivering, on the bathroom floor. This cold square of tile on a hot night in a hot country, and I can't stand up to go back to bed. I can't stand up. So I sit there quietly, shaking as if I were sitting in the snow. And in the corner of the bathroom, brown against the tile, there's an insect, big like a water bug. It's flat, heavy, very tough legs. They look like metal. And it's waiting, squatting, deciding which way to move. And in a second, it's crossed behind the sink, and it's slipping itself into a hole too small for it to fit in. But it fits in. It fits. It's gone. And I see myself. I see myself. A moment of insight. It's the birthday party in the fancy restaurant. Yes. There's the table with its sweet and pretty decorations, the fanciful centerpiece, pink and green. And there are all the women in bright red lipstick and the men in beautiful shirts. And all the gifts, outrageous, unexpected, and funny gifts. And there are the waiters serving the salmon and pouring the wine. And there I am. I'm talking quietly with that small, pale woman in the red and blue dress about the love affair with the older man. That film that disturbed her. The actress, the psychiatrist, the criminals. The walks at night through the woods and the country. The insatiable appetite for violent sex. The suffering of the people who live in desperation in the crowded shelter across the street from the fancy restaurant. And as I talked with that woman in the red and blue dress, I thought I was a person who was thinking about a party, who had so many complicated feelings about it, who liked some aspects of the party, but not others, who liked some of the people, but not all of them, who liked the pink and green centerpiece, but didn't really like that red and blue dress. But no. No, I see it so clearly. I see myself with my little fork. I wasn't a person who was thinking about a party. I was a person who was at a party, who sat at the table, drank the wine, and ate the fish. That's it.
I love the way you read. Or act. when you go to third world countries, does it make you feel guilty for what you have and what people around you don't? I mean, is that the emotion that you often come away with?
I wouldn't describe myself that way, no. I mean, I actually like to be in poor countries, and I'm very happy in poor countries, and I'm, in a way, more relaxed in some of them than I am at home. And
why is it?
Well, there are many things. I was, the last time that I was in Guatemala, I was in a town where there were a lot of American and European tourists, and it was amazing how self-important the Western tourists seem somehow, that each one of us feels that it's so important what clothes we put on each day. And we walk down the street with a feeling that we are unique and fantastic individuals, whereas something about Indians who were living in the town was you could see that their assessment of their place in the universe was so much more graceful as well as modest. And I find that, I mean, there's something sick, of course, about a person with money loving to hang out in Mexico or Guatemala and enjoying the
enjoying how poor people makes him feel good.
Right. Enjoying, you know, the basic, you know, the sort of decency and lack of arrogance of poor people, which has come to some extent from their suffering. However, I'm simply telling you, if you want, you know, you asked about how I actually feel.
Right.
My main emotion as a person is really that I actually like being there. Obviously, in certain places where there are some of the places in Central America are so terrifying because of the violence that is being inflicted on the people, that you couldn't possibly have a relaxed moment.
My guest is playwright and actor Wally Shawn. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Wally Shawn is my guest. The fever is in part about being privileged. I want to quote something from the beginning of My Dinner with Andre, which you wrote. And your character says, and this is in the early narration, "I grew up on the Upper East Side, and when I was 10 years old, I was rich. I was an aristocrat riding around in taxis, surrounded by comfort, and all I thought about was art and music. Now I'm 36, and all I think about is money." And the context of that is that you were, you know, the character is kind of broke. That's why he's thinking about money all the time. But I'm wondering when you started to think of yourself as privileged.
Well, I suppose that in some way, I always did, but the truth is that when I was 36 and wrote that passage, I was totally obsessed with my own problems and the fact that, you know, trying to pay my own rent and trying to win some recognition for myself as a writer or whatever. And I'm now 47, and say My Dinner with Andre itself sort of changed my situation in life to some extent. People said what they'd never said about anything that I'd done before, namely, oh, that was a good job. You did a good job. That was good. And people gave me jobs as an actor for which I was paid money and I paid my rent, etc. And somehow that was one of the things that was in the background of my beginning to, I don't know, turn against myself, if you will, or recognize in myself the enemy of humanity or whatever you want to say. In order to keep me and the other members of my class in what we think of as normal comfort, the poor of the world have to be suppressed, really.
You know, in some ways, it sounds like you should go back to being an unappreciated writer, so you wouldn't have any money, but you'd have a kind of more, relaxed mind. You wouldn't, you know what I mean? You wouldn't be worried about having to live at the expense of others.
I was more relaxed at that time, and I may say more fun to hang out with for other people in a certain way, because Robert Brustein said of me in
the drama critic.
Yes, Robert Brustein, the drama critic of the New Republic, said in the New Republic that I was developing the suppressed rage and pinched features of the fanatic. And he expressed a kind of compassion and practically in his review offered to come down to New York and help to take me to a good therapist. But the truth is that he's basically right.
Now, how is this affecting the other part of your work? And I'm thinking of, acting. I wonder if these thoughts that you're feeling now, the guilt, the kind of, political weight that seems to be, an incredible burden, if that's affecting your interest in performing in other people's movies.
In the sense that I really don't believe in movies, and I think it's immoral to spend that much money on creating a movie, it does present a kind of an obstacle. I would be much more admiring of a nun who teaches school in a little village in El Salvador than I would be of a character actor in a $25 million movie. So since I happen to sometimes be that character actor, it does present something of a problem at times, yes.
But you have a real gift for acting. I mean, you're not a nun in a third world country. You're a really fine actor. It seems, it seems almost pointless in a way to deny that and to wish for a life you don't have or to deny a gift that you do have.
Well, the fact that I can't reconcile the contradictions in my own life doesn't mean that I shouldn't admit them.
Right. right.
In other words, I actually do believe that books, plays, films, television programs that affect the way people think and feel are of absolutely crucial importance in changing the world. They're not enough. I have a residual belief that doing something truthfully is in some way a value in itself that ultimately will lead in a good direction, so that you can say to yourself with some plausibility, well, if I act truthfully, even in this film that is not great work, that I'm making some contribution. However, I think that's mostly self-deception because most films are not neutral but are actually harmful and spread disgusting and evil thoughts and feelings. I do try to not do things that I know in advance are disgusting and evil, but because of my animalistic desire for comfort and for not leaving my apartment and not having the telephone cut off, I'm sometimes thrown into a conflict, you know, and kid myself and think, well, this one is not so bad, when maybe in a cooler moment I would have thought, well, really, it is that bad.
And it seems to me like it would probably be, that it's probably in a lot of ways a really good experience for you to act and to leave your own self for a minute and enter somebody else's, you know, like the character self.
Yeah, it makes me very happy. I love acting. And I love, I mean, we're talking now, I'm not trying to say that people are clamoring for my services the way they did previously. I mean, I'm definitely in a period where people are sick of me and that I'm not being hired so much. But when I am hired, I love that. I can't tell you how much I enjoy getting away from myself and my own thoughts and committing myself to the task at hand and hanging out with lots and lots of people it's quite, it's such a relief for me to do it that I think I'm better at it than I used to be because I totally throw myself into it because it's such a pleasure to throw myself into something other than myself.
Writer and actor Wallace Shawn. Tomorrow, Shawn brings The Fever to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles for a 2-week run. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what stories do you have about Iraq?
Well, we'll be hearing about the United Nations Security Council adopting a resolution on reparations that Iraq will have to pay to other countries, including the United States. And while denouncing that resolution as illegal, the Iraqis evidently have agreed to pay up to 50% of their oil export revenues in the near future for the payment of reparations. Also, John Itzty reports today on what effect the U.S.-Mexican Free Trade Agreement, if there is one, would likely have on American workers. And we'll also hear one man's complaint against the new run of colors, the range offered by Crayola Crayons.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Czech writer Milan Kundera has a new novel titled Immortality, but book critic John Leonard says this is not the author's most enduring work.
Milan Kundera writes this novel in front of our eyes, in a deck chair at a health club with a swimming pool on a Paris rooftop. He's showing off. He really wants to discuss the end of Europe, the end of history, and the end of culture. But to keep us turning his pages, he'll make up a story from chance encounters with enigmatic strangers, and radio reports of anomalous events, and imaginary conversations among the lofty likes of Goethe and Hemingway, and snippets of books and shards of autobiography. Into this story, he interpolates little essays about journalism, sentimentality, coincidence, astrology, and phases of the erotic moon that turn out, of course, not to have been digressions at all. Everything fits inside with a satisfying snap, like the hasp on a jewelry box or the folding of a fan. Left in the air, like smoke, are ghosts and grace notes. There is Paul, a lawyer who drinks and despairs. There is Paul's wife, Agnes, a computer expert who leaves Paris for Switzerland because she has decided she doesn't love Paul anymore, or not enough. There is Agnes's sister, Laura, an haute couture shopkeeper who thinks she loves Paul and so plays Mahler on a white piano and collects money for African lepers in the Paris metro system. There is Professor Avenarius, a friend of Kundera's, who's falsely accused of rape. And there is Rubens, the Don Juan obligatory in any Kundera novel, who strolls with the mysterious Gothic maiden in a park among what the novelist calls the severed heads of the famous dead. All these characters are unhappy because God is dead, and neither sex nor politics will guarantee them a life ever after. In all of European culture, there are only 50 or so geniuses who will deserve remembering after they are dead. Paul, Agnes, Laura, Rubens, and Avenarius are not among these happy few. Linear time, romantic poetry, modern art, the idea of progress, revolution, and nostalgia have let them down. They're short on meaning and being. Class inequality, we are told, is but an insignificant shortcoming compared to this insulting metaphysical inequality. Not even their unhappiness is original. They have borrowed it, like their gestures, from Goethe, Beethoven, and Napoleon, from Cervantes and Shakespeare. So much high culture, and what has it got us? Auschwitz and the Gulag. I won't tell you what happens next, except there's a surprise death. I will say we've been here before, in previous Kunderas. He told us in Laughable Loves that sex is powerless against socialism, and in Life is Elsewhere that poets will always sacrifice shop girls for the good opinion of the revolution, and in The Farewell Party that Western civilization, based on the individual and his reason, has come to a violent end, and in The Book of Laughter and Forgetting that cultural progress is no longer possible, and in The Unbearable Lightness of Being that the horror of history signifies nothing. What's missing in immortality is the radiance of Czechoslovakia. After 20 years in exile, place is irrelevant to Kundera. Immortality, however witty and often dazzling, is a deracinated novel, a sacred monster ego, one of those severed heads of the famous dead. It seems to float on the water, in the air, trailing its nerve strings like cut cables, as if Kundera were saying, "I am the 51st genius, an immortal artist." Back in Prague, of course, history went on without him. He jumped ship before it set sail into a new meaning and a new being.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Immortality by Milan Kundera. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Dan Laughlin, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1981, legal history was made when a white jury in Alabama turned in a $7 million verdict against the Klan. It effectively bankrupted the group. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the man who fashioned the lawsuit, Morris Deeves, and we discuss his career as a civil rights lawyer in the South. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.